Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas is now in session pursuant to adjournment.
Thank you. Be seated. This morning, the court has three clauses on its oral submission docket. In the order in which they will be presented, they are as follows. Rita K. Oliver versus Robert I. Oliver from Gaines County. Shakiko U. Womack versus Barbara Redden, a secretary from Bowie County. And FR Cattle Company Incorporated versus the State of Texas from Erath County. The times that we have allotted for oral argument have been announced to the council, and petitioners may reserve a certain portion of their time for rebuttal argument by so advising the marshal of the court. The lights have not been working for the last several weeks, but we advise that they do work this morning. So you'll receive a green warning light with 5 minutes to go and a red light when your time has expired. These arguments are being recorded for the convenience of the court. Please, if you desire to listen to the arguments, you may apply with the clerk of our court to listen to the tapes. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each of these arguments, and we'll complete the arguments before our lunch break. Court is now ready to hear argument from petitioner in Oliver versus Oliver.
And please the court. Mr. Douglas Foster will present argument for petitioner. He is reserved 8 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. My name is Douglas Foster. With me today is Mr. Kevin Bartley, and we represent the petitioner, Rita Oliver. The facts of this case are unusual, to say the least. Indeed, these facts might be more appropriately characterized as bizarre. While it is probably not unique for a married couple to divorce and subsequently remarry, I believe that it probably is unique for a married couple to divorce and yet continue to live together, continue to sleep together, each and every day, representing themselves to each other and to the public as husband and wife for the next 9 years following that divorce. Yet that is precisely what happened in this case. However, these bizarre facts do not render this case a mere novelty. The issue here is bigger than whether Rita Oliver should receive the money that the jury believed she deserved. This case requires the court, number one, to interpret an important but infrequently interpreted statute, section 16.069 of the Civil Practice Code. In addition, this case requires the court to revisit the question of who bears the burden of precision in jury issue submission. And finally, this case requires the court to consider whether a fiduciary, any fiduciary, whether that be a husband, a wife, or any other fiduciary, can escape the consequences of his fraud merely by alleging that that fraud should have been discovered through the exercise of ordinary diligence.
Isn't that what the jury found in Issue 6?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. That goes to the heart of the second point on our appeal. And I refer back to my comment that the court must consider who bears the burden of precision on jury issue submission.
I'm not aware of the term burden of precision. Is that in our jurisprudence?
Do you mean burden of persuasion?
No, I really don't.
Is unique to, something unique to New Mexico?
No, sir, it's not. It's a term that I'm using. I don't believe it is a term of jurisprudence. By that, what I mean is that the jury issue submitted, number six in this case, did not address in total the statute of limitation defense.
Did you object to the issue?
We believe the record reflects that the issue was objected to.
Did you request an additional issue or instruction?
No, Your Honor, because that was unnecessary due to the fact that the issue was a defensive issue and not an issue that my client would have had to submit anything on. And furthermore, while there is argument about whether the objection that was made was clear enough to advise the court, I submit that no objection was necessary because the issue as submitted was immaterial to the issue before the jury. The issue before the jury, as submitted by Rita Oliver in broad form, was whether the jury found by a preponderance of the evidence that Sam Oliver had defrauded her as to their status as husband and wife, as to their marital status. That was the broad form issue.
And that includes limitations.
I'm sorry?
And that includes limitations.
The broad form issue that was submitted by Rita? If it does, the jury found that there was no limitations bar because the jury answered that issue in favor of Rita Oliver. And the counter issue, if you will, the statute of limitations issue that Sam Oliver attempted to submit addressed one and only one of the acts of fraud that were admitted in evidence to the jury. They addressed in that issue number six only whether the entry of the New Mexico divorce decree should have been discovered, and if so, when. And the problem with that was it was what I believe the term being used now is granulated. That was a granulated issue submitted by Sam Oliver in response to a broad form issue submitted by Rita Oliver. The case is analogous to a more typical, more simple case of negligence, where more than one act of negligence has been alleged by the plaintiff. If the issue is submitted in broad form as to whether the defendant was negligent and whether that negligence was a proximate cause of the injuries, the defendant cannot escape the effect of that broad form finding in the plaintiff's favor by selecting out one act of negligence, one of many acts of negligence that were both alleged in the pleadings and submitted to the jury by evidence, and obtain a finding that that one act occurred outside the statute of limitations. Because that leaves the balance of the broad form finding in favor of the plaintiff standing in full force and effect, because the defendant, and that's where I mentioned the burden of precision, the defendant had the burden of being precise in his submission of a defensive issue. The defendant either had to match the broad form issue submitted by Rita Oliver, who was the plaintiff counterclaimant in this case, the defendant either had to match that broad form submission with an equally broad form statute of limitations issue, and as we've suggested in our brief, one appropriate question would have been, when do you find that Rita Oliver should have discovered that Sam Oliver had defrauded her as to their marital status, which would be an exact mirror of the broad form submission by Rita Oliver. But instead, for whatever reasons, Sam Oliver chose to granulate the defensive issue and ask only about the discovery of the New Mexico divorce decree in 1979, thereby ignoring all the other misrepresentations as to marital status that occurred from Sam Oliver subsequent to that, which are cataloged in our briefs, but which included, among other things, the filing each and every year of tax returns with the federal government and the state of New Mexico that represented them to be husband and wife, represented Rita Oliver to be his spouse, all of which, by the way, were amended once Mr. Oliver finally filed the formal petition for divorce in 1988 and went to a lawyer to get his assistance. They then went back, interestingly enough, and amended all of those tax returns to claim that he was single during that entire period. I believe my time has expired. There are no further questions.
Are there any questions? Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court. Mr. Tom Herman will present argument for response.
May it please the court, Mr. Foster, Mr. Bartley. I'm going to argue the case for the respondent, Sam Oliver. Mr. Shelton Mr. Travis Shelton from Lubbock is also counsel in the case, but I will be presenting the argument for the respondent, Sam Oliver. Actually, I think this case is a lot broader than the petitioner in this case would have you believe. First of all, there are no findings of fact or conclusions of law in this case. None were requested and none were found. So this is a case, first of all, in which the court should affirm if it can be upheld on any legal theory. Findings supporting it.
Excuse me, sir? Wasn't this a jury trial?
Yes, it was a jury trial.
Findings of fact and conclusions of law appropriate in a jury case?
Yes. Remember, this is a divorce case, and because we have no findings of fact and conclusions of law, we do not know why the court did what it did. You know, did the court base this case upon, for instance, upon statute of limitations? We don't know. The court could have based it upon there being no evidence of fraud. The court could have based it upon there being no measure for the damages, that there being insufficient evidence for any kind of damages in the case. Could have said that since the recovery in this case would be community property.
Didn't the jury make some fact findings?
Oh, yes. And those fact findings, of course, we're bound by. No question about that.
They found evidence of fraud.
Yes, but the court could have found that there was not sufficient evidence to submit the issue. You have to go back and read this record. You can't always take what the petitioner says in the case as being the facts, and I would encourage you, when they tell you something, go back and read the record, because they don't always quote them right. For instance, Rita Oliver says, and this is practically a quote from her, "Sam never told me anything that was not true." She assumed that the divorce did not go through. She never says Sam told her the divorce did not go through. She just assumed that. She says, he never out and out fibbed to me. He just never said nothing. There's considerable question about whether that's sufficient to go to the jury on the evidence, on the question of fraud. And since we're talking about, remember, we're talking about not only findings of fact by the court, but conclusions of law by the court. So there are lots of questions other than the question of statute of limitations in this case. Fraud requires some kind of material representation, misrepresentation. And here we conclude from the testimony of Rita Oliver that she did not ever say there was a material misrepresentation.
Ms. Burnham, is it your position that the operative fact here is that the divorce decree actually was entered and the jury found that she should have known that went through at that point?
That's correct.
Once that happened, that she should have known, you're saying that any subsequent representation or action by Mr. Oliver indicating that they hadn't been divorced is not a reoccurring fraud because the operative facts should have been known?
That's right.
So anything he said after that would be immaterial?
That's exactly right. I couldn't have said it better myself. That's exactly our contention. We also say, you know, just as a matter of constructive fraud, I'm not fraud, constructive knowledge, once you file a divorce decree, you know, remember in this case, she signed the waiver of citation. She signed it before a notary public. She signed the divorce decree. She signed it as approved. She had a copy of the divorce decree in a tin box where she had been previously divorced, in the same box that she kept her previous divorce decree. She had all of this in the same box there. You aren't talking about somebody going down and doing something without her having some kind of knowledge as to what was going on. She knew that there was a divorce proceeding. She signed the waiver of citation.
She signed the division of property and the divorce decree. She signed all of those things.
Why didn't that knowledge keep the common law marriage from being valid?
Well, you didn't have a common law marriage in New Mexico because...
I understand that.
Okay. In Texas, we just simply took the position from the start that they were a common law marriage. That was never really an issue that was tried.
Even though there was an agreement to divorce?
Yes. But see, after they came back to Texas, they were holding themselves out to be husband and wife, and they were living together as husband and wife.
Just as they were in New Mexico.
Yes. But remember, too, in Texas at that time, the statute required, created a presumption from the fact that they were living together as husband and wife in Texas and that they held themselves out to others, created a presumption that there had been an agreement to be married.
But your view of it is that she knew that they did not have an agreement, then there wouldn't have been any common law marriage.
No, there would have been a common law marriage. I think there's a common law marriage no matter which way you go, once you get to Texas. Once they're holding out and living together in Texas, I think that makes a common law marriage, even if they were divorced in New Mexico. Okay, another area that I think is important in this particular case is the measure of damages. You will notice that that in this case, the measure of damages, there is none. It just says, what damages did she incur? Just a blanket thing. There is no evidence to support any damages in the case. Just none whatsoever. I mean, you just pick a number out of the air.
Ms. Firm, did Mr. Oliver at the time of the follow-up divorce take the position that the property accumulated during the years in New Mexico was not community property?
Yes. It is separate property.
And New Mexico, how would New Mexico have dealt with the property acquired during the marriage had they not had the divorce in New Mexico?
New Mexico is a community property state. I'm not all that familiar with New Mexico law.
Didn't Ms. Oliver have some prejudice to her by there being a legal divorce in New Mexico for the years they lived there before they came back to Texas and established a common law marriage? I mean, couldn't she claim that she lost some interest in property in New Mexico because New Mexico did not recognize common law marriage by the action of Mr. Oliver?
I suppose she could, from a logical standpoint. I don't know from a legal standpoint.
So wouldn't it be Mr. Oliver's responsibility to protect the record on the measure of damages in the face of a broad form submission? Isn't there some evidence that some evidence of damages to Mrs. Oliver by the lawful divorce in New Mexico, for which she no longer received credit for the property accumulated when they moved back into Texas?
I think I understand where you're
so
coming from.
So if there's some evidence of that point, then why isn't Mr. Oliver's burden to create some instructions on the proper measure of damages?
Well, I don't think there was any evidence, and I think even the petitioner points out in their brief that there is no evidence of the accumulation of community property during that period of time.
So your response on the damages is there's just no evidence. You're not really objecting to the fact of the no measure of damage.
Well, I'm objecting to both. Okay. But there is no evidence there either. It's simply my point. And I don't think that it is Mr. Oliver's burden to have to submit an instruction as to what the measure of damages is. That would be Mrs. Oliver's burden, would be to show what the measure of damages is and submit that to the jury. Let me go for a little bit talking to you about the statute of limitations. When you get down to that, and I think that's that's only one of several points and is not the governing point in this case. But the entire question, as Judge Ennis pointed out, the entire question here has to do with that initial time, right as the divorce was taking place. Without that, none of the rest of the things that were mentioned matter. The tax returns actually is a representation by both of them to someone else. That if that was defrauding anybody, it would have been the United States government. Tax returns were later filed to remedy any wrong in that area. None of those things really matter. The critical question is what happened on December the 11th, 12th, and the 17th of 1979. And there is the question here is whether 16.069 applies of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code. And under the Civil Practice and Remedies Code, whatever the counterclaim is, first of all and foremost, is it must be filed within 30 days of the time the answer was due. There was no cause of action in the original answer or in the original counterclaim. There was no cause of action filed for the tort of fraud. The cause of action for the tort of fraud was filed in the second amended counterclaim, which was right around a year later. Now, I know in petitioner's brief, they say that we conceded that was filed timely. If you look back to the site in their brief, we did not concede that it was filed timely. As a matter of fact, we said exactly the opposite. We said it was not filed timely. So note that difference in the brief. And it has been our position consistently at all times that it was not filed timely. But second of all, it is not applicable anyway because we are not talking about the same occurrence or the same incident. Remember, what we're talking about is a tort that supposedly happened in December of 1979. The parties at that time were not married. They were married in August of 1988. Or December, may have been December. Sometime in 88, anyway. We're talking about some 9 years later. Those are two totally separate occurrences. That is, the cause of action that they allege in fraud happened in December of 1979.
What particular incident is this?
That was the time of the divorce. The divorce in New Mexico.
Is she arguing a continuing tort, including misrepresentations through the years and the acquisition of property and holding themselves out to the world, and apparently, whether by words or by actions or deeds, a misrepresentation to her that they were still married, a misrepresentation to the Internal Revenue Service that they were married?
That's what she is contending. That is not supported by the pleadings and was not supported by the evidence. The pleadings talk about the tort happening in December of 1979. Then it talks about that is supported by later acts. But
the pleadings say that is the tort or that was the initiation of a continuing tort?
My view is they say that is the tort. Now, remember, I have some advantage in this thing. I've been involved in this case all along. Rita Oliver now has different lawyers. This is not the position that was taken at the trial court. They did not take the position at the trial court that there was a continuing tort. The position at the trial court was that there was a tort in December of 1979. It has only been in the appellate process that they have taken the position that this was a continuing tort.
Well, Mr. Purdom, did Ms. Oliver take the position that the marriage occurred back in whatever it was, 78 or 79?
Yes.
So isn't one of the issues in a divorce when the marriage occurred? And if Mr. Oliver says the marriage was a common law marriage, wouldn't it be a factual determination as to when the... I mean, I'm assuming Mr. Oliver's taking the position that common law didn't occur until the date they moved back into Texas. But isn't she free to contest the date of the marriage for the purposes of community property and property distribution? And so then doesn't the claim of the tort occurring after the first day of the marriage come within the purview of when we're arguing about when the marriage occurred?
No, she took the position at the trial court that the marriage occurred at the same time we took the position. As a matter of fact, in the court's charge, there is an instruction as to when the marriage occurred, and that instruction was submitted by Rita Alden. It was not submitted by Sam Alden. When the court's charge says that the marriage occurred, I believe it's in August of 1988, that specific charge was submitted by Rita Oliver, was not objected to by Rita Oliver, and was not objected to by us. So at the trial court, that was the position she took.
Any other questions? Thank you, Counselor.
Thank you.
May it please the court. I would welcome the court's reviewing the transcript references in our briefs and reviewing the transcript to see whether they are accurately stated. Among other things, it is simply not true that Rita Oliver failed to allege the tort of fraud in her original counterclaim. Now, what respondent has admitted is that that original counterclaim was timely filed. What they refuse to admit is that there was a fraud counterclaim alleged. However, I would refer to the court to pages 14 and 15 of the transcript in this case, which contains the original answer and counterclaim. I'm going to read to the court a portion of that original answer and counterclaim and hopefully dispose of this issue once and for all. Counterpetitioner Rita Oliver alleges that through fraud, misrepresentation, and breach of fiduciary duty existing between spouses, counter-respondent attempted to terminate the marriage of the parties in the courts of New Mexico on or about December 17, 1979, that such decree was obtained without counter-petitioners being represented, knowing her legal rights, and after material misrepresentations of fact and law were made to her by counter-respondent, that in fact the marriage relationship did not terminate, that the parties never ceased living together as husband and wife, that they continually held themselves out to the public as husband and wife, filed joint income tax returns, and agreed to be husband and wife, and that such decree was obtained in fraud upon her rights and in violation of the fiduciary duty the counter-respondent owed to counter-petitioner. The court should hold such decree null and void or should set the same aside.
Counsel, where is the fraud? If she signs the waiver citation, she approves the divorce decree as to form, as to sign, she agrees to the proper settlement agreement. Where is the fraud?
The fraud is that having induced her to sign only a waiver, Your Honor, she never approved the form of the divorce decree. She never received any property distribution or property settlement. There's no evidence of that. After signing only a waiver on December 11th at the instructions of her husband, she returned home. And he told her, and it's quoted repeatedly in the briefs, he told her, don't worry, honey, we are still married, we will always be married, we will always be husband and wife. And that was the last she heard about it. And it is not true that the record reflects that she had a copy of the divorce decree in the special box. Her testimony, which was uncontradicted, which is cited in our application for writ of error, is that she did not learn that the divorce decree had been signed until 1988, and that's at pages 136, 138, and 141 of Volume 4 of the Statement of Facts.
Now, the jury found against her on that issue.
No, sir, they did not. They found that she could have or should have, with reasonable diligence, have discovered the entry of the divorce decree on December 17, 1979.
Under Texas law, isn't that precisely the test as to when limitations start to run on fraud?
It's not when there's a fiduciary involved. When there's a fiduciary involved, for good reasons, actual knowledge and notice of the fraud is required.
Absent. In essence, in addition to the divorce action, this is a case of a fraud for breach of fiduciary duty.
That's correct.
Had he not defrauded her, she would have been entitled to a community interest in whatever property they accumulated while they were in New Mexico. And in that regard, in a second, I'd like for you to address measure of damages and evidence of damages. What you seem to have to be arguing here is that marital relationship or no, during their period of years in New Mexico together, there existed a fiduciary duty.
That's correct, Your Honor. Two things. First of all,
because of the circumstances of the relationship.
That's correct, Your Honor. First of all, the fiduciary duty clearly, as a matter of law, existed so long as they were married. And remember that they weren't divorced until December 17, 1979. And in that interim, from the day she filed a waiver on December 11 to the entry of the divorce decree on December 17, they were still husband and wife under any definition, and a fiduciary duty existed under any definition. And Mr. Oliver had an obligation as a fiduciary to make full disclosure during that period. But what did he tell Rita Oliver? He said, don't worry about all this divorce business. We will always be married. We will always be husband and wife. Nothing will change.
And you object to the trial court submission of this fraud form submission, I mean, this question about the statute of limitations being not correct.
That's correct, Your Honor. It was objected to as a rebuttal issue. The transcript reflects the objection was that's a rebuttal issue. And then immediately following that, the transcript gets very garbled. And the Court of Appeals said, well, we assume they must have been talking about some other special issue. But the objection was made.
Well, no, I'm saying the objection to the question as not being proper under the circumstance of this case.
That's correct.
But rebuttal is a different issue. Did they object because it didn't require actual knowledge?
The trial lawyers did argue to the trial court. And I'm sorry, I don't remember whether there was any argument like this made before the submission or whether it was purely post-trial. But the argument was made, and the references are in our briefs, a motion, I think they called it a motion to disregard special issue, and they argued at that time specifically that due to the fiduciary relationship between the two, that actual knowledge of the fraud was required, and that the normal discovery rule for fraud was not applicable, and that therefore that special issue answer was immaterial to the statute of limitations defense. That was argued.
Mr. Foster, the Court of Appeals liked that in order for you to come within the purview of that exception, that it was incumbent upon you, your client, to obtain affirmative findings that a fiduciary relationship existed. And as you did not do that, you did not come within the exception. I mean, that's what they wrote in their opinion.
Yes.
What is your response?
It was a question of law because the evidence concerning the relationship was undisputed. The only thing that had to be decided was whether that relationship created a fiduciary duty, the facts being undisputed about what the relationship was. And Sam Oliver never said, no, we didn't live together for the next 9 years. No, I didn't help with the kids. He never denied the factual elements of the fiduciary relationship. And under the Lacey versus Tycor case that we cite in our application, the existence of a fiduciary relationship was therefore a question of law. Otherwise, the court would have to submit jury issues on all kinds of matters that are undisputed that are really to be determined by the court itself. So that was a question of law. Now, if I can quickly get back, because Justice Gamage asked me about the measure of damages. First of all, there was evidence in the record that Sam Oliver's net worth at the time of trial or at the time the petition was filed was $6 million. And the jury was not allowed to consider what portion of that he had acquired as potential community property during the time the parties were together, because the jury was also instructed that the marriage began in 1987. The common law marriage in Texas began in 1987.
And you requested that instruction?
I'm not sure about that, Your Honor. I can't stand here and tell you no, because I'm not sure about that. But I want to point out something else, that besides what Rita Oliver lost in the way of New Mexico community property, she also lost the value of her services as a wife. And I don't think that those can be lightly dismissed. She testified.
Isn't that an archaic concept, counsel, nowadays? The value of service as a wife? Housekeeping? Sexual relations? What are you talking about?
Well, all of those, Your Honor, and I don't think it is archaic.
Bright,
under the wrongful death statutes, Your Honor, any person is entitled to the lost value, the value of lost wages, and I don't think that the value of household services is an archaic concept at all, and I don't believe that the women think so. The point is that all we were required to do was demonstrate that there were damages and allow the jury to reasonably conclude what the value of those damages was. And Rita Oliver testified, not surprisingly, that had she actually known in 1979 that Sam Oliver had divorced her, that she would not have stayed with him. And I simply do not understand.
This one's still in response to the justice's question?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. It was intended to be.
Okay. Are there any other questions?
Did you complete your response?
I've lost track now, Your Honor, so I guess I better say I've completed.
The question was, what was the measure of damages and what evidence of damages were there? Was there?
Well, I don't think there, very briefly, I don't think there is a measure in the typical sense like there would be in a uniform commercial code case. It's not the cost of cover. There's not that kind of measure. The issue is whether there was evidence of damage and whether the award is reasonable in relation to that evidence. And my answer is yes, there was ample evidence that because Rita Oliver relied on the belief that she was married to this man, she stayed with him, and she acted as his wife for an additional 8 years that she would not have done otherwise. And I don't think you can say, that anyone can say, that has no monetary value. Thanks.
Any other questions? Thank you. That concludes the argument in the first call. The court will take a brief recess.
God, would you please rise?
Thank you.